Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling otherworldly.
Ooh, that's a nice feeling.
And I'm also feeling contemplative, because that's actually a word also that I associate a lot with today's guest's work, just because of the kind of intensity of the paintings. There's just an aura to them, which is really contemplative and actually like kind of has really affected both of us very directly. It's really powerful work. But I'm also thinking about myth making and myths and storytelling and autobiography and all these kind of ideas merging in one, which kind of gives you maybe a starting point for today's guest work if you don't know it already. Many of you probably do, because over the past few years, our guest work has definitely reached some amazing heights and international galleries. There's been epic solo shows in Hong Kong and, yeah, all over the place. I think Belgium and New York, even London. And I know, Russell, you've been the person that actually introduced me to their work. Yeah, I'm really excited as well to talk about materiality today, because today's guest just explores so many different types of materials, and even like shellac, which is a kind of resinous secretion of lac beetles as a material, and lots of different sort of approaches to making work. So it's a very conceptual approach in a way to painting. And we are thrilled to be speaking to today's guest. So we would like to welcome all the way from New York,
Brooke Shoe.
Hi, Brooke.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm really good, thank you.
You've got some banging in the background there. Where are we finding you? In a warehouse where they're doing some work?
It's a studio building. One of my neighbors has been doing some work all day. I have no idea what, but it's pretty loud, so I apologize.
Are you friendly with your neighbor?
Well, I just moved into this new space, so I haven't met them yet, but hopefully.
That's a really nice welcome.
I'm usually friendly with most people.
What is this new space? What's this new space you've moved to then? Where was you coming from and to?
Well, I was based in the Bronx. I still live in the Bronx, but my studio was there for the past 6 years. And, you know, it was just time to move. I wanted heat and some, you know, just general comforts that I wasn't getting. So I moved into a new space just a couple weeks ago.
Is it a bigger space? Do you feel like you're every studio?
It's actually smaller.
Oh, it is.
That was one of the benefits of being in the Bronx. But I also have a studio I built out in Wyoming, which is bigger. I started living part-time in Wyoming, so I'm working between two places right now and just trying to figure it out.
What took you to Wyoming?
My sister and her family live there. That brought me there first, and then I just fell in love with the place as well. I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in Oklahoma, and
yeah,
there were always times where I was like, oh, what am I doing here? Like, I'm a country girl. I miss it so much. And after like a few years of pretty back-to-back like work just basically no breaks, always working. I just kind of took a pause and went west and was like, well, I'm just going to stay, okay?
Was that quite a brave thing to take a pause? Because I remember this happening, and I remember you were quite vocal on social media about this need to sort of step back a bit, because it became a bit all-consuming for you, because your trajectory to success was very, very fast.
Yeah, it was really quick. Yeah, I got a lot of people asking me if I was okay when I posted about it online.
I think I might have been one of those people,
I was like, oh man, that probably sounded like really intense. But I was totally okay, but I definitely reached like a depth of a kind of loneliness. I've always been someone who loved my solitude, but the amount I was working, and to be a painter, which requires a lot of time to yourself, it had gotten to like an extreme. The job side of being a contemporary artist is sometimes like tasking. So I just made this like decision, and I feel like there's this feeling that it's hard to say no. And it's a really hard one to learn, but I decided to take the opportunity to just like say no and try to live a little bit more in the way that I felt like I wasn't living. It did feel like a risk. And there's some times where I'm like, oh, did I make the right decisions? Yes, I definitely made the right decisions. I feel so much happier.
Do you? How long did you take to get? How long did you give yourself?
About like almost a year, because I had to like move and stuff. I still painted. I was always working, but I just haven't been showing a lot. And I moved. Had a museum show I was offered and I turned it down, and that was a really hard decision to make. Solo show, I moved back like 2 years, and I just was like, I made a lot of big changes, but I still like, you know, the work and being an artist, like that's something I've just always done. I've always lived for it, and that never stopped. So it was just like being like engaged publicly that I took a pause on.
That happens to a lot, and I'm sure a lot of emerging artists who are in your sort of position will listen to that and be inspired by that, because that is an act of bravery. And from the outside, you'd be like, what are you doing? It's all going so well. Why would you do that? But if you're thinking long term and your career and for the rest of your life, you have to put these pauses in yourself almost. Do you know what I mean? Just to sort of gather your thoughts, just to be present in the world again.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think it was possible for me to find, like, I really believe that the thing that I look for in painting is, or in art making in general, is form, and that it can be new. And the only way to really do that is sometimes to take a step back and like really take a moment and then come back to looking at things. I sometimes spend like years on certain works that they can kind of feel like a problem child, as a good friend of mine said the other day. She called them problem children are sometimes like the best paintings, but like, yeah, they they're like the ones that like really take a lot of time, and like the only way to finish them is to like come back to them, maybe even years later.
You moved to New York in 2011, and this is somewhere that you now spend half the time in Wyoming and New York. But what was it as a young artist that New York was the place where you felt you needed to be?
Yeah, I was living in Kansas City, and this is just where it all, like, all those stories came from New York. I mean, I also spent a couple years in LA, like, trying to, like, follow that, like, that California dream as well. I've really searched for a place, but New York, there's nothing like the density of art making here for like the past like 150 years or whatever. It's so special, and I worked at the Strand.
Yeah, you worked at the bookstore when you first moved. Yeah. We love the Strand. They stop
we
talk
love it there.
Every time we go to New York, we pop in and we sign all the books, and we're like, we love you guys. They're the best.
Yeah, I worked in the art department.
Oh my God, amazing.
Kids, and just, I just was always like a lover of books, and so that was like a place where like I felt like I could still be myself and not compromise like who I was, and still like I worked the late shift and I would paint in the mornings in my bedroom. And I did that for a few years. Never showed or anything, just painted.
I think you said, to quote, that you want to make love to books. That's how much you're in love with books. So that must have been an amazing place to work with lots of sensations. So you
I was in ecstasy.
Every day.
Knowledge.
How did you find art? I know that you were raised by a family of landscape
architects,
sorry. So that's obviously thinking of, you know, structure and design and creativity, obviously. How did you find art?
I come from generations of artists, like, and women also. Like, my great-grandmother was a artist. She studied at Cooper. My grandmother studied at Pratt. My mother studied at a few places, but Pennsylvania Academy of Art, and then eventually finished at Cornell in landscape architecture. It's just like, and then on my dad's side, it's also, I think someone was a, great-grandfather was a puppeteer in Taiwan. Yeah. It feels like it's in my blood, but like learning about like the history of art, which is a whole other thing, and like painting and the academic side of it, like that was like a long journey to arrive there. I didn't really interact with art like until I was like in my teens, but the first, like, I feel like the first, like, artworks I was really interacting with were the, like, masterpiece Zen gardens in Japan that my dad took me to. And learning drawing from the perspective of design graphics that he taught at Oklahoma State University. I would sit in his classes and take the workshops when I was like in grade school.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I don't know if he saw like a gift in me or something. I don't know why he like let me like go to these things, but I went and sat through them and loved it. I loved drawing. Even in kindergarten, my mom's had saved my report card, and the teacher's like, we can tell that she's really like bright, but like all she'll do is draw. Please get her to do like try to like write words or anything. Like, I was like saying I was an artist when I was like very young, and just never stopped.
That's really amazing.
Yeah.
And would you live with the artworks that your family members had made? Would you grow up with them around you?
We didn't grow up with too much. My grandmother's paintings, yes. And my dad, yeah, I guess when I really think about it, we did. But like they also put me in like painting classes when I was like 12 or something. I started learning oil painting when I was quite young, and they hung my paintings up too. Like, we had that, and we had like I didn't feel like we lived with like a, like I visited people's houses once I was like in my later teens were families who did collect art and was just like, whoa, like this is crazy. Like, I can't believe like this kind of art exists in houses.
Like what?
That
what was
not
you seeing?
Something.
What was you seeing then?
Like a Balthus painting above a couch, or like a Giacometti. I just had the privilege of meeting, like, randomly falling in love with someone as a teenager who was, like, you know,
rich.
for rich and aristocratic. For a girl from Oklahoma, like trying to fit into the aristocracy of France was just, like, I was not cut out for it. But I tried. But I got to see some amazing artworks in them. And it really did, like, kind of catapult me into a different like view of what I thought I could do as an artist as well.
It's really interesting to me that drawing was such a early thing for you as a way of communicating. And I heard that all of your paintings pretty much will start from the point of a drawing, which I just didn't realize until researching this episode. For some reason, your paintings to me feel like the opposite of drawing, because I know they often have figures in them and there's a kind of drawn element perhaps. But to me, they feel, you know, like we were talking about you took a year to make a painting or these problem children where you might take 3 years to make a work or something. That's more like what I see in the work. There's this real depth of emotion, depth of skill, depth of kind of rigor to the work that's very specific to you, actually. And I find it really interesting that your starting point is actually just a drawn line, like from your hand, like in that very pure way with a pencil.
Yeah. Usually actually with pen, surprisingly, which is something I realize is what I learned early on in my those workshops with in the landscape architecture department. But drawing is the core to me. I think other artists have said this too, but it's definitely almost like one-to-one connection from me, like deep in my core, out. Like I can get it out. It's very much like, I don't know, like some, I don't want to relate it to vomiting, but it does kind of feel like that sometimes.
Well, I'm going to segue from vomiting then to puke to the color green, because people come into your work, the kind of the green wash that goes over predominantly most of your practice was inspired by a friend vomiting, and you saw the color green come up in the puke, and there was something about that color that stayed with you that then you thought, oh, I want to make that into my art practice. Can we talk about that moment? Why was she throwing up green?
Well, that was like one of my best friends. She was actually quite sick, and sadly she's better now, which is wonderful, but she had had to have like a pretty big surgery, and I went to be with her for it, and when she came out of the operating room and was then getting situated into her own room, she had all these bags of fluid, you know, because you have all the bags, and then I guess it must have been because she's completely emptied. The stomach was completely empty. Because every time I've thrown up, I've never thrown up this color. No. It's usually like this kind of like yellowish, more yellow color, like not really green. But this is like this like pure, like soft green color, probably from all the painkillers or something, the medications. Mm. But it just kept coming out. And I think like this, like because I have this deep love for her, I love her. It just stuck with me so intensely, the color, the sensation of it, and like the desire to really empathize and care for my loved one. And then at that time, I had a solo show that I was preparing for in Detroit at this gallery my friend ran called Bahamas Biennial, Biennale, I forget. It had a really funny name. And that was when I, just all the materials were present in the studio. I had green in the studio all the time. I used it more like kind of in a seasonal connection, like whenever spring would happen, I would feel like this desire to work more in green, but it was always a more like acidic green, the soft like palette green that I started to try to achieve happened after seeing my friend vomit. And then I went and tried, and a lot of those works, all of that was my first all green show, the one I did called Fruiting Body for Detroit.
So do you feel like you're bringing your friend into your practice every time you make these green paintings? You must be reminded every time you see this color.
Yeah, I think of her. I definitely do. I mean, it's many other things too, but that was like a catalyst. There's often, I feel like there's things that are like catalysts that like really like cause like the switch or like give confidence or that final like push to do something that I had been afraid to do previously. But she's definitely present in the paintings. There's a lot of things that I think about every time I make a painting.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, from reading lots about you, I think the main theme is love. That's what seems to drive through this. The green came from a love for your friend and this deep love. I mean, most people, if someone's thrown up, you wouldn't consider that as something that would inspire something within your creativity. But this did because it came from a place of love and care and nurture and protection. And we see a lot of images of skeletons in your practice, but there's something about them that are treated with humor, but there's love, like skeletons, like the lover's grave. There sees these two skeletons lying together. They might have books nearby as well. There's always books around, sexy books. And these skeletons are full of love for you. And is that right to say that throughout the practice, that's the main driving force for your work?
It has been. I mean, I've gone in and out of feeling like it was right to use that word or something. It comes out of almost a political belief too. It's spiritual, but it's also one where I believe that if we were made from this place, we would satisfy all of like our parts. We would, it's not to be like this, like I this be in a moral quandary, but to be in a place where the world empathizes with us and the artwork is able to provide that space for the viewer where maybe the everyday experience has like fallen short because struggle is inevitable. And love, and there's people who write about it much more eloquently, I feel, than I can state right now, because I feel like it, for me, it's done in images and through material and experience. But I really believe in like what Thich Nhat Hanh says, that love is understanding. And I try to approach art making from that belief.
There's a really beautiful quote you said before, which was, "I seek to understand what we value in life by asking how we value the world." And that really struck me, because I think that really summed up so much of how I felt about your work in relation to what you just said about love is understanding, like this idea of value in life, and then how that, you know, if you actually think about in your core what you really value.
Yeah, it takes reminding oneself sometimes, or being reminded by someone else, that could even be a stranger on the street, or a plant, or a brick. I don't know. It could be anything, a rock. But these things remind us of our values. I for instance, it'd be like if I'm holding, I don't know. Have you ever like found a rock that you thought was just like, I don't know, it could look like so like nothing to like your friend, but like to you, it's like the most beautiful thing on the face of the planet. Somehow it just like aligns with like these little things in you that you didn't realize you had. And I feel like those are where we find the language for what we believe in, which is also the things that we value. Not everyone values the same things. Not everyone believes the same thing. So it's like, it takes these moments to be reminded. It's almost to also be reminded of oneself, to have a love of oneself. That's like part of the core of it.
I like you saying that love is political. And I mean, I agree with that. And as myself and Rob being gay men, I mean, that's political in itself. Is art making, working from that place then, a political act for you?
Yeah, definitely. And it's full of like an insecurity because like it can be really cheesy sounding I don't know, like I look around and like I can feel kind of like envious of other artists sometimes, but then I'm like try to remind myself that, you know, to be accepting of who I am, and that it's taken a long time to get to this place of assuredness in like my hand, and but
what would you be envious of in other artists then? What are the things that you would go, I wish I had that, or I'd like to be there, or what is it?
I think like I feel it the most in, or like I've been looking a lot at Francis Bacon lately.
Me too.
And I don't know what it is about his paintings that I used to not look at. I only recently have looked at him like a lot and been reading everything I can on him. And I just, there's things he discovered, and I just long to paint a human the way he figured it out. Like where it looks beautiful, like a person, but then it also contains like that kind of like ugliness that it also is beautiful in people, but, and the, just the harshness and brutality of being alive. I'm so jealous. But it's like, I think a healthy kind of jealousy that just makes me strive to continue to find my own form.
I feel like with Francis Bacon, he really got that aura thing, like the kind of it's you can't actually draw it. Say it's more like a, if you're in the room with someone, you can feel their energy field, and I actually think that makes sense that you'd be interested in that, because from your work, I also take that idea of an aura. Like there's an energy within your work which resonates really strongly, like a vibration. You know, if you're looking at a painting of yours. It's actually very unusual, like, and it's not, it's not even just a spiritual thing. It's like actually something to do with the way you're making paintings. So I think it's interesting that you've gone there to Bacon.
Well, I think from what I'm, and there's almost like a science to it, I could believe. Like I've been reading Gilles Deleuze's writing on him, which is a wonderful writing called The Logic of Sensation. Oh.
Which Russell has right in front of him.
Wonderful.
That's so funny.
It's like, like if you are a painting nerd, a painting lover, like that book, it's so wonderful. But he really like has a way of putting into words that it's maybe in the chapter on hysteria that he talks about sound. He talks about music. He talks about how our body, he talks about the body without organs. And I can't explain that, but like as a painter, as someone who makes paintings, I definitely believe that we use this word resonance, like something resonates. And there's the question always of when something's done. And I definitely think that a painting resonates to me when it's finished, or when I'm making it, when something's going in the direction that I want it to, that it has resonance. And it is like a vibratory feeling. I definitely have like a sensation in my body that I feel when I look at the paint and the shapes and colors. And from what it sounds like when Deleuze writes about Bacon, that he believes that Bacon also was like experiencing this kind of resonance when he was working, because the paintings create that vibration through like his whole core, through the eye, because painting goes through the eye, but that it's almost like a paradox of the eye, because like you hear and taste and feel all these sensations through it, and you kind of lose your whole body in it.
I think for Francis as well, as he was working in a place of chance and accident, and he would make mark making that then would trigger another mark making. Do you feel like you channel that within your practice? I think there's two sides to your work, where there's a lot of figurative works, where they be skulls or satires or like creatures, but then there's this really abstract kind of spirals and everything. And it feels like in that place, you can have this chance and accident. You can allow yourself to be, give yourself over to your hand, to your instinct,
mm-hmm.
or your subconscious, yeah. Not your instinct. Like you know, well, it is your instinct, I guess. Yeah.
I think instinct is a great word to call it, and subconscious too. They both kind of like go and relate to totally different trains of thought, but they're both pretty accurate. But I definitely follow my gut. Yeah, it's you feel it in like that. That's right, and that's like, it's so like always on the tip of my tongue. Like it's never like fully words, especially when I'm making an abstract work. It's like just this like mumbling sound that I'm fumbling through in my head to my hands through the paint. And it definitely feels like one thing has to lead to the next. But I also have like a vision for the final painting. Whether it ends up that way isn't always the case, but sometimes it happens.
What is it about the skeleton, the motif of the skeleton? What does that give you in your language?
Oh, I love skeletons. They're so fun. I feel like they were more present in art, maybe like in Western art in the Renaissance or Middle Ages, and then kind of just got like relegated to Halloween. But they're always smiling, and then I feel like
they're
from
grinning,
like,
aren't they? I heard you say that. Yeah. When all the flesh falls away, we've got this kind of grinning face for eternity as a skeleton.
Yeah, we smile for eternity. It's in there. And I feel like it's like a lesson in living. The skeleton is a lesson in living. Yeah. Because it's like to smile brings you a sense of calm.
Mm. Well, going back to Bacon, he said he could never paint the smile, and every open mouth was a scream.
He had a couple where he did try to paint it, like that really like a really like creepy like Cheshire grin.
Yeah, like them earlier ones with the ones at the base of the crucifix and they're kind of their teeth. Like terrifying, not nightmarish scream, not a scream you're gonna receive from anybody.
But then skeletons also, like with the ink paintings, they're so fun because they're also like when drawing them, they fall apart into line in a way that I can play with. And yeah, I've said it in the past that they lend a sense of humor to the work that I had feared it lacked for a long time. I always worried about the work being morose or melancholic. And I really wanted to have I have a sense of humor. Damn it. Like, I want to express it somehow. And they presented an avenue for that.
How does autobiography play into your work? Because if you think of someone like Bacon, obviously there was a big autobiography element very directly in his work. And I know that it does inform your work too, but I was just curious to hear from you directly.
Yeah, for sure. It's hard for me to believe that any artist's work isn't somewhat autobiographical, but I don't want to be so like, that's what it seems a bit mean. Mine, for sure, everything comes from something I've experienced, and everything comes from something I've felt, and I put that into the work. It's very much my life in material and image, and I've shared some things about my life, but you know, everyone has like the things that they, you know, their secrets too, and those are there.
You rework an image over and over again. We see the skull, the elongated skull, which I think I shared with you, and I was like, oh my God, I've finally realized that maybe where you'd been influenced by it was the Holbein's Ambassadors, where you have this kind of elongated, like optical illusion skull at the bottom, which doesn't make any sense why it's there. But that has kind of appeared in your work. You reworked that image and the skeleton and the spiral works, and I read you saying that repetition is a gift, which I find a really lovely idea. What does repeating a motif over and over again help you work out?
It's back to that same thing I said about trying to understand how I value the world and believing that the thing that can be new is form, that form can change, and that I'm looking for form. And repetition is one of the best ways to actually be able to see it carefully change, and then to actually study the forms that, like, because you look at other painters too, or other artists, like, we often are drawn to like the same things, and we'll paint similar things or similar themes or genres, or I have my own like maybe vocabulary that I return to, and it's also like, and maybe this is like helpful for young painters too, or young artists, that feeling like you have to constantly reinvent the wheel is a big task that is maybe gonna be more of a hindrance. To allow oneself to return to something that you've made, and just maybe you just wanted to see it in a different color, and that's it. That's enough. Like, it's totally okay. Don't have to solve all the world's problems in one painting. Like,
can't actually.
So better just to, like, if there's like that feeling or thought to just see this thing differently, like, go for it.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I think people come into your work.
That's really liberating.
Yeah, it's liberating for sure. I think people come to your work as well as so the colors, something, the green, the imagery, but also the scale. And there's a lot of these works that are on lumber wood. So these are offcuts of wood that are hand sized, that are these incredibly intimate, beautiful, beautifully rendered works. I'd love to know how this scale became something that you felt really confident to work on, and it's continued to be in your practice, and what that also gives you.
That is probably the longest standing, oldest part of my practice that I like continue now, is these paintings on offcuts of lumber. And it started in undergrad, but then I really became more like aware of it when I was working at the Strand and had like very little means. So I would get pieces from friends' wood shops that just the shape resonated, and it was free, it was their trash, it was my treasure. So I made the best of it. But then when it came to producing more work, like the size of the lumber and just like getting like a piece of wood at like the hardware store and then it being like this ready sized material that I could cut into easily into this many same size panels lent itself to that, back to the conversation on repetition and the ability to try to see form repeated. Again, what you had said about it being liberating, like I saw freedom in this material that allowed me to continue to paint every day instead of like feeling like this pressure, like a new composition doesn't come every day, but the desire to paint does.
With this repetition, then there was a green line. I just want to talk about an exhibition then where it was the green line. It was last year, and it was 24 of these very intimate paintings all lined up together that went around this the architecture of this space in this old 900-year-old church in Rome. I think it's called the San Andrea de Scafis, if I said that right. And I sadly didn't get to see it in person, but seeing images online, it must have been the most incredible experience to be in there. And what an amazing exhibition, and to have your work really defined by the architecture of a space, and to tell this like narrative, or whatever, your projected narrative onto this like single green line going around the space was just incredible. What was that like, and how did that come about?
That was like a wonderful opportunity I got to show in that church. I was so ecstatic when it was offered to me, and I didn't know at first what I wanted to do, but the director at Gladstone that had offered me the opportunity, he really loved one of the first like extra skinny stretched skulls that I had painted, and coming from this like belief in love and like connecting to people, like I took it to heart that piece resonated so much to him, and meditated on it, And when I visited the space, I had like this thought that, oh, it would be so beautiful to continue that. I'd only made one, but to do it again, to approach it again, to see it as a line around the room. And then, I mean, that piece was insane to make off-site, and to be exact down to the millimeter to get it to fit together of all, like, 24 panels all fit together. Sauro, who works as the head prep for that church, just knows the space so intimately that he was able to, like, help me put it together, like, in a way that I think it took someone really intimately understanding the architecture to be able to piece it together, and the team was so helpful too. It felt like a very team effort, even though, like, making those paintings was such, like, a task to do it all on my own. But it felt, it all came from this, like, desire to connect and empathize with the things that were resonating with people.
It's really interesting as well, you discovered at that point, when it came to the galleries making PDFs of available work for people, that these really long, skinny paintings just didn't transfer onto a PDF. So they just look like a green line, and people, you couldn't see in the detail. And it was like, oh shit, I hadn't really considered actually how you're meant to photograph this and show it together. That must have been frustrating, but fascinating and terrifying at the same time. Yeah,
I think for painting, it's almost painful that, like, it's so much of it is online, because I think what we've talked about, material and how important that is to painting, like, you really, it's so hard to get that in a digital image. Maybe you get it a little bit more in a book, but it's so difficult. And it was just, like, to me, it was funny that I'd made something that just, like, maybe aligned, like, too much with my, like, opinions about digital representation of images. Because I really have pushed back on, like, I also have asked galleries not to, like, post the, like, the documentation, like, installation shots are wonderful. Like, I love sharing installation shots or, like, shots of work, like, in the studio and stuff like that, that gives a sense of, like, place. But these, like, cold images of, like, a painting, like, that are, I struggle with it. And so, yeah, like, people are like, I don't know what I'm looking at. Those long, extra long paintings, because they went up to 8 feet long.
Wow. Well, you said painting suffers under the thumb of commerce. So I guess that's the perfect example.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
You know the space in Rome? I went there before. Sadly, I didn't see your show there, but I've obviously seen all the installation shots, which are spellbinding. But when I went there, we were trying to find it, but then we sort of accidentally found it. Like, we didn't realise where it was. And we sort of stumbled across it. And the door was just open at the time because it was an installation that was, you know, all the way through the space. And you almost had to watch it through the doorway, I think. And it really made me think about Rome and the history of Rome and the way that you can go into any church in Rome and you end up seeing a masterpiece that you're not expecting to see. And this kind of sense of discovery and wonder and, like, elevated spirituality as well. You know, whether you're religious or not religious, it doesn't really matter, because I feel like art in Rome, it'll take you somewhere you weren't expecting. Was that an exciting opportunity then, and in that sense?
That was so exciting. Yeah. Like, the interaction of art through just walking down the street and happening upon it in Rome is unlike any other experience I've had in any other city. And to get to participate in it, and people do just wander in. Like, when I was there doing the install and everything, and afterwards, like, people just wander in off the street. That Rome gets so much foot traffic, and just the thought of knowing that that random person spent maybe even 5 seconds in it is wonderful. And I wish that was more the case for people, that they could experience art in this way. It's hard to have that in most cities. Rome is so special that, like, and I think people there, I don't know, they kind of seem very happy. I feel
they have really good food as well.
They have really good food.
Yeah.
And they have wonderful art.
It got me thinking about mythology as well, because myth making and mythology is a really big part that informs your work. And if you think about Rome and the history of civilization and, like, I don't know, all the myths that just came out of that one culture per se, I know it's not the only culture that you would have referenced, but it's really fascinating to then show your work there.
Yes, it is. I don't know how to talk about myth at all. Maybe you could help me. I feel like it's, you know, like, I wish I had studied the classics and Greek and everything. I don't at all. But there are these things that I've been drawn to, like stories or characters and images that I've been drawn to. I wanted to tell my own version of it. And I feel like for an artwork to be enigmatic, like, I believe people, I mean, back to Bacon, who, like, really fought against the story. He really fought against it in the paintings. He really wanted, like, the sensation of existence, like, now. Like, I want to give this. And I also believe that part of that existence now is this desire in us for stories. If I get to be old, I want to be able to tell good stories. That's all I want. I want to be able to tell really good stories. I want to be that old person that's really good at telling stories. That's it. I love it. And I think, like, art can provide that space for people to develop storytelling.
Well, writing's incredibly important to you. There's amazing writing that is available online by you, and you've published books, and there's also text that appears in your art. I remember once I saw a drawing that I think was a menu for mushroom risotto, and I think it was out there as a work of art. The fact that you see, like, your font and this spiral line that then goes through the way that you write words, and then they become art. So writing, it feels like, is as important to you as image making.
Yeah. I mean, in connection to myth and, like, mythology, and maybe if we go to, like, Greek mythology, with language being so tied to the word, and then all, I feel, spiritual practices being very tied to word, and word is like a living thing. I don't want to have a doctrine. I feel like this is just something I've just always, I'm stubborn about it. I want no doctrine. I want no rules in this way for what I believe. I want spiritual freedom. And to see that in something like mushroom risotto recipe is where I have that too. To see life and feel alive through just even the words on a menu, I think makes me feel that kind of joy and humor and all, like, every human emotion, I feel like.
Well, it was a good recipe. I haven't tried it, but it looks lovely.
Let's do that. You can cook it for me, Ralph.
Brookshoes mushroom risotto.
We're gonna have a Sunday with mushroom risotto.
Our friends over. So I want to talk about. Rob mentioned it in the intro. Shellac, which is, you know, you said you use pen, oil paint, graphite, but shellac. I mean, it sounds fascinating and also equally disgusting. It's something that a beetle secretes. I would love to know about. What is shellac? Where does it come from, and how did you come by it?
Well, I came by the material through an art material supplier that deals more in traditional materials. They're based in Germany, Kremer Pigments, but they have a place here in New York, and they have just done a wonderful job of preserving historical materials. Not all art companies are... It's not always important to an art supply, material supplier, but Kremer does a wonderful job with this. And they make this shellac diluter. They've tried to tell me how to make it, but it looks, the process is, maybe it's simple to them, but it sounds complicated when I like look at it. And I think they do a beautiful job. So I appreciate that they make it and I can use it. And so I mix the colors and everything for my inks and everything. But this shellac is the binder. And it's a really strange material. It's probably not like some of the earlier ones that I've made where I didn't quite know what I was doing have cracked a lot, and they probably will change significantly like over a shorter amount of time, which is interesting. It's a pretty brittle material. It used to be used to coat vegetables and fruits as like a preservative. You can eat it. And I mean, and maybe in small quantities, you shouldn't drink this stuff. But it's made from the secretions of the female lac beetle, which is pretty fascinating when it comes to sustainable materials, because you have to try not to kill the beetles because they're the ones producing the material you're after. But the female eats saps from certain trees and then secretes a resinous fluid pretty much constantly, secretes the burrows where like all the babies live and everything. And it's just these kind of like bulges that happen on the trees that they live in. Those get knocked down and cleaned, and that's like the shellac.
Is that expensive?
It's not cheap, but it goes a long way. I have like the paintings I feel like I make, like I paint on like scrap wood and with a very thin water-based material that can be extended quite far. So I feel like it's cheaper than using like high quality oil paints on or even acrylic, actually, the way I use it. And to mix, if you can put your own pigments into it as well, like you can have a pretty high quality like color, pretty intense color.
And what was it about shellac that appealed to you as a surface? Like, is it like pleasing to paint with? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
I struggled with acrylic. I mean, I was after something. I was painting on carpet, and I always wanted to figure out how to express myself on canvas. I was heavily criticized for my canvas paintings. I was told at one point to never touch canvas again, even. And I was like, oh, but I was like, but I want it. I want to participate in this conversation so badly. And this belief I had about material, I really wanted, and the carpets express this, like the things kind of bound together, the material, the paint, the pigment bound with the substrate. I wanted them to be one. I don't know why. I just really wanted them to feel like they were one. And then I had this, developed a process with the ink, painting on an absorbent ground. And the way it bleeds into this surface is intensely pleasurable. It has almost the sensation of of working on paper, which is a beautiful material. Canvas is not always so beautiful. It's almost like I was fighting against the canvas all the time until I figured out how to use ink on canvas. And then I just ran with it.
You talk about your love of books and reading, and I've learned that you draw most when you're reading, when you read books, and you will then be inspired to draw. What is that process? Are you picking up a book? Because I'm someone that's a note maker, so I'll read a book and I'll stop and I'll write something on my phone, then I go back to reading. Is it the same sort of process as an artist? Do you stop, do a drawing, then go back to where you were reading from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will do that. I underline in my books and write in my books too. I usually read with a stack of printer paper by my at hand.
Oh,
and
wow.
I just write on printer paper mostly, or I'll draw. Like I did this portrait of a girl with the word science, and I painted the word science a lot for my show at Kiang Wulang in Hong Kong. And it came about when I was reading a chapter, an essay on Sigmar Polka, and I think they were writing about his the relationship of his material investigations through historical pigments and more non-conventional materials used as painting materials, and what that might have said about Germany's political presence in World War II. And I was just like, what? Okay, hold on. I need to try and make sense of this. And somehow, like, wherever I was in my head and my experiences at the time, this little sexy girl came out with the word science. And I was like, okay, great. I think at the time, Roe versus Wade had come back into the Supreme Court and was getting voted on, and we were losing our rights to abortion. And so I think I was angry also when I was reading it. And when you read it, and some word hits you just right, it relates to wherever you're at and in your life. Like, that's the time when I draw something out or write.
Mm. The erosion and kind of taking away of women's rights in America, I know that was like obviously a theme of that, or a part of that show in 2022, I think it was. But I know that you referenced Agnes Martin and Jutta Kurter, two artists from different generations that are both so incredible. And it was really interesting to me that you referenced both of them. Can you speak a bit about their work?
Thanks to Jutta Kurter, I greatly admire her as a painter. And I had done a text work of an excerpt from her lecture on Agnes Martin years ago, and I had saved the drawing that I made. So when I've done text works, I usually write out all of the words, and that was like a transcript of her talk, and it was on orange paper, and I framed it in this like big green painted frame, and was the centerpiece to the entrance of the show, actually. I wonder sometimes why Jutta Kurter chose Agnes Martin, or maybe she was invited to talk about her. I have no idea, but it's almost like this funny pairing at first, but then it makes so much sense to me Jutta Kurter is very much a cerebral painter for me. I mean, maybe more of her recent works are less so. They've started to delve into like a kind of emotion that maybe I didn't feel in them before. But Agnes Martin also was someone who I feel like really came from careful thought, from a place of working and careful thought. And as to maybe selfishly insert myself into their lives as well and say like, hey, Brooke Shue cares about what you guys make also very much. I think very deeply about the things you decoders painted. And as well, Agnes Martin and their writings. And I just wanted to connect, to continue and see myself, whether the world sees me or not, in the same like trajectory of female artists.
Mm. Well, you're in dialogue with them for sure. And the title of that show as well, I really wanted to mention before we moved on, but it was called Oranges, Clementines and Tangerines. And I remember hearing that title and being like, what? Because your work is all green, you know, predominantly. I know there's obviously the orange paper, but I loved it as this kind of poem almost. It's like a about colour somehow. Like, can you explain that title? Because I love it.
Yeah. I wanted a title that maybe was, I mean, it's playful. It almost just doesn't make sense. Like you said, at first you're just like, what? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And I, as well, in the conversation of food, it was something that just connected to everything, like to the beliefs about color and the sensations that they create. The belief of importance of food and our connection to it, and through like the use of ink as like a material that is coming from an animal's food that they eat, to my autobiographical participation in my own work, where I was eating a lot of these fruits when I was making the show, and it was just this plain and simple thing. I had bought all these oranges, clementines, and tangerines at the store, wondering like, what the hell is the difference between all these things? And then like to the end where like it's to my belief in form, like I love the fruit as an object, as a form, and I love the orange because when you peel it, you can create lines from its peel. Like I love, like when you peel an orange and it turns into a spiral. So you really have to like delve into like thinking along lots of layers with that title, which I enjoy.
I also like the freshness of it, like the vibrance of those fruit. Do you know what I mean? Like if you think of drinking it or biting into one, or I don't know, there's just like a present freshness somehow.
There's definitely a freshness about them. And they tie back to Asia, like a fruit. I mean, they just have such a huge history. Like I liked it because it could unravel so many different avenues. And that show itself, like I made that show and the show at San Andre Discafis like simultaneously. It was a lot of painting all at once. And I was like, I honestly, like, the show, I want, like, and I got criticized, like, for, like, you overhung it and this and that, and, like, you put too much. I was like, I really wanted to just shove a bunch of stuff into the space and not necessarily have made it feel like it had to make so much sense, like, that those things come out of, to allow myself the authority as, like, a young artist to just try things out and not have to sound like everything was so intentional and everything means something. Like maybe the meaning comes later and we understand things through the looking, and let's just cram a bunch of as many paintings in the space as possible so we can see them together, because that's a rare opportunity.
Yeah, like a testing ground. I mean, yeah. In a way, you should be able to have that luxury as a young artist. You're really young, aren't you, really? I mean, you know, in the scheme of things, it's like you're just, at the beginning of your career in many ways. I know you're not, but like, you know what I mean? You should be free to experiment and try things out and not have all the answers. It's just unfair, expectations.
Expectations are the worst. And luckily I work with galleries who allow for that kind of play and allows me that kind of space to continue to cultivate my vision.
Yeah, that's lovely. Well, can you tell the difference now between an orange, a tangerine, and a, what's the other one?
Clementine.
Could you try for mandarin? You can tell the difference. Can you?
Oranges, tangerines, and...
What?
Clementine. If we blindfolded you, Brooke, and we put a segment of each one in your mouth, could you tell us if it was a tangerine, a clementine, or an orange?
The clementines and tangerines would be really hard because it's mostly like a size thing and like a slight sweetness. But the orange for sure because it's huge compared to the other two.
There's a giveaway. Okay,
and the chocolate orange, definitely.
Definitely.
Well, we're going to get to our final questions now because this has just been amazing. Thank you so much. The three questions we ask every guest that comes on. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any artwork in the world for yourself to live with in your studio or in your house, wherever you wanted it to be, what would it be and why?
Wow, an art heist. View of Toledo, El Greco.
Oh, right. Where, have you seen it in the flesh before?
You know what? It's back up at the Met now. It was down, and I tried to go see it when I saw it rolling away on a cart on this day of desperation where I was just like, I gotta see View of Toledo. I gotta see it. And I went to the museum. They were closed. I somehow got in because a friend works there randomly who I hadn't talked to in years. I just called him and I was like, I have to see this painting. Desperate. And we get there and they're rolling it away on a cart.
No. Why?
They were renovating or something.
Oh my god.
And
that's why we have to steal it for you.
Yes. We have to steal that painting.
It's meant to be on view at the moment at the Met though, in Gallery 619. So we know the address.
It just came back. It's gonna leave because I'm taking it.
We're gonna help you.
I have to live.
If it goes missing,
it's got some really great use of green in that painting as well.
Incredibly,
so that's handy. Oh, you know, talking about green, we didn't talk about green panic. There was this reference in one of your shows to this idea of green panic, which is like a grass or something. Did you know that?
I think someone else talked about that in a review. I was not aware of it before, but it was
I loved it though as a term,
thing that
like
came
green
out.
Panic.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Sounds like a band name.
Someone has got to make a band named Green Panic.
Yeah. The other question on that is, note,
yeah, what is your favorite color?
Blue.
Is it?
Yes.
Why? So it's not vomit green.
It's blue.
No,
it's blue.
Amazing. Well, that's one for the books. I wasn't expecting that at all. what is it
about blue that you love?
I love to wear blue. I love to wear blue. I love to write in blue. I think it's a very special color because it's one of the few that isn't actually real. Like the way green is, the green's the color we see the most of, or our eyes are designed to see the most of it. But blue's almost immaterial. It's very special. I feel like I just identify with it in some weird way.
Great.
Well, it's otherworldly, which is what I described you as in the intro.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art, Brooke?
Oh, the best advice I've ever received was to get a table and to get a couch.
In where? In your studio or in your house?
In my studio. As a studio artist working I was just on the floor with no comforts in a, what did someone say? They're like, Brooke, this is like a convent. You can't be in here all the time and not have a couch to sit on. So it was very important things that I learned that actually opened up a lot of space for me to do what I was trying to do the whole time, was just to have a little bit of furniture.
I love that. Mm.
That's almost like self-care, isn't it? It's like practicalities. I like that a lot.
Yes.
You're amazing, Brooke. Thank you so much for doing this with us. This has been a really special chat today. Go on, Rob. You got another
Can I ask
question?
You one more question? Some of the paintings you made, uh-huh. which are like landscape, they're sort of more figuratively like, you know, they've got trees and things. Are those, did you ever see Ken Kiff's work? Do you know about Ken Kiff?
I don't think so.
I'm going to send you a book by him because we did a show of his in Margate, where I live, and he taught Tracy Emin to paint, and he made these paintings which I think you're going to absolutely love. Yeah, Art Forum just wrote about him twice, actually, recently.
Yes,
but I'm going to send you those. I'll get your studio address. Yeah. Cool.
Well, I have one more question about work then. So the flute player, the image of the flute player, and the small panels, there's like two skeletons throwing up. Is that a reference to your friend, or is that a reference to an art historical image?
The flute. It was just that painting came about just, I mean, the first flute player I painted was from looking at a painting of Krishna, and I reinterpreted it, and then those, which was a ink work, it was a large canvas, and then later I did these small paintings of it, and they really were just, it was one of the first times where I combined motifs that I was painting in the larger works into a small painting, looking for a new type of way to work within that format.
Well, lovely. I love that. This has been amazing, Brooke. You are on Instagram. It's quite a long, it's your name, but an elongated version, like an elongated skull. Your name is elongated for Instagram.
We'll directly link to that.
I think it's at Brooke. And I don't know how many O's are in there. Do you know how many O's
15.
You have? There's 15 O's. Okay. Yeah. So it's at Brooke for anybody listening. It's an amazing page. You are very present and show a lot of the workings of your studio and what your, you know, how your practice is going and the sketches and studies and everything. It's a really wonderful resource. I absolutely love your page. So everybody listening should go to that. Then we can link you to your galleries.
Yeah. I'm represented by Kyung Malang and KTZ. And I'll do another show with Gladstone coming up this year, but nothing official. But that's it for now.
Right.
Perfect.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. We are so grateful that we had this conversation, and thank you for your generosity. And we're happy to see you and hear your voice and be able to share your work with everyone listening. So we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye. Bye, Brooke.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.